Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. China's National Bureau of Statistics announced last Wednesday that China has posted an annualized GDP growth rate of 7% in the second quarter of 2015, the lowest rate of expansion from the world's second largest economy since 1990. This figure is contrary to predictions of some economists and observers who had predicted an even lower growth rate amid weak global demand and a slowdown in local government infrastructure investment. Over the past 9 months, the Chinese government has deployed significant stimulus measures, including monetary easing and the partial rollback of an uneven fiscal reform plan introduced in the second half of 2014. In Seoul, a National Intelligence Service agent was found dead in his car on Saturday in the midst of a controversy over whether the agency spied on South Korean citizens. Police concluded that he died by asphyxiation due to charcoal fumes from inside the car. The mystery suicide comes against the backdrop of the latest WikiLeaks release of over 400 gigabytes of leaked data from Italian surveillance malware vendor Hacking Team, which indicated that Korea's NIS purchased hacking programs from it in 2012. The man left a three-page suicide note that denied the NIS monitored ordinary Koreans. Officials stated that the man was in charge of managing and purchasing the software for a surveillance program, but was not a hacker. In Tokyo, rhetoric intensified as a new Japanese defense assessment called on China to halt oil and gas exploration in the East China Sea. Japan released aerial photos of China's construction activities there, accusing Beijing of unilateral development and a half-hearted attitude toward a 2008 agreement to jointly develop resources near disputed islands. China's defense ministry argued that the release of the report revealed the two-faced nature of Japan's foreign policy and reserve the right to take action. In Malaysia, mudslinging continued in the unfolding financial scandal that threatens to engulf Prime Minister Najib Razak and the political party he leads, the United Malays National Organization, better known as UMNO. State investigators believe that nearly $700 million in cash moved through Malaysian government agencies, banks and companies connected to a state-owned company linked to the Prime Minister before ending up in Najib's personal accounts. The firm now faces at least $11 billion in debts. Najib's former political mentor and one-time Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, has stated publicly that vast amounts of money need to be accounted for by Prime Minister Najib. As a result of the scandal, Malaysia's currency, the ringgit, is down 8.1% and foreign reserves have dropped 20% from this time last year. And that's the news. This week we turn to the Philippines, a US ally with an increasing military budget, key presidential elections next year that could reshape the future of Manila's domestic and foreign policy, and a fast-growing economy that may be finally hitting its limit due to a lack of infrastructure investment and modernization. My colleague and Cogitasia editor Jeff Bean caught up with Greg Poling, fellow with the Sumitra Chair in Southeast Asia Studies, who recently completed a study on the Philippines to get a sense of what trends are shaping the country.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Bean. My guest today is Gregory Poling, a fellow with the Sumitra Chair for Southeast Asia Studies. I want to talk to you, Greg, a little bit about the broad perspective on the Philippines. I know you traveled to Manila recently and finished a project that focused on what's happening in and around Manila right now. Obviously, we have an election upcoming next year in 2016. So the current president, Aquino, will not be available to run. We'll have a new president. And there are a series of domestic challenges and foreign policy challenges on the table that the country is facing. Can you give me an overview of where the country stands right now in terms of its domestic politics?
Yeah. So, as you said, Aquino is stepping down. Philippine presidents are term limited, 1 6-year term. So he's already kind of entering his lame duck period. And domestic attention is very much focused on who's going to succeed. Now, for quite some time, the vice president, Jejomar Binay, who's in the Philippine system, the president and vice president are elected separately, so he's not of Aquino's party or his ruling coalition. He was, for quite some time, seen as the man to beat. He has been lambasted in the press and now is facing charges, including by the Commission of Audit, regarding some call them irregularities, graft allegations when he was previously mayor of Makati, the business district in Manila. That's also called up several of his associates and his son, who's the current Makati mayor. And we've seen, after people assumed he was kind of Teflon, that these wouldn't stick, over the last few months, we've really seen his poll numbers start to plummet. At the same time that Senator Grace Poe, who's an independent senator, whose father is was a movie star and a elected senator and formerly a presidential candidate, she's seen her star very much rise. She's kind of seen as outside the system, and the family name brings in a lot of credibility. She, you would say, caucuses with President Aquino's ruling coalition. She ran with the coalition in 2013 when she was elected, but she is nominally an independent. She's now leading the election, the polling, by quite a margin. And the only other guys on the field are, at this point, seem like also-rans, including the Interior Secretary, Mar Rojas, who was Aquino's chosen successor, but now seems pretty close to being thrown overboard, given his rather dismal poll numbers.
And what do you think is the status of the economic situations in the Philippines as it relates to the election and the broader attitudes as it relates to investor confidence and the challenges that the country faces in modernizing, developing its infrastructure, and yet at the same time continuing to grow at the rate to which we've come to expect in the last 10 years or so?
When you look at the overall macroeconomic situation under this government, it seems to be fairly universally positive. Just looking at the broad numbers, it's had the Philippines over the course of the Aquino presidency has had the fastest growth rate, second to China, among developing Asian nations. There has been some concern that that overall growth rate has not resulted in a narrowing of the unemployment numbers, hasn't resulted in a narrowing of the inequality gap. They're starting to see some movement there, but clearly, while investors, central bank, these kind of guys are very happy, there's still a great deal of disquiet among the masses in the Philippines. And you're seeing that played to quite a bit as the election heats up. Everybody kind of wants to continue Aquino's successes in the macroeconomic sphere, but are pushing very heavily on how they're going to be the man to really help close the unemployment problem, really help boost more inclusive growth numbers.
Or the woman.
Or the woman, exactly, in the case of Senator Poe. Now, looking out long term, beyond just the kind of the short term boosts that GDP numbers have had, the country still faces enormous problems. After decades of underinvestment, infrastructure remains a huge problem. Like other neighboring countries in Southeast Asia, it is wildly expensive to try to transport things by road in the Philippines. Bureaucratic red tape can be an enormous problem if you're trying to set up a business. There have been efforts under the Aquino administration to fix some of these problems, and there's been some moderate successes, but they're not seeing the kind of inward investment that you would expect from a country with these numbers. They're still trailing behind other neighboring powerhouses like Vietnam. And on the infrastructure front, the Aquino administration has really put all of their eggs in the public-private partnership basket. And yet the process of getting those large public-private projects off the ground has been so Byzantine that we've seen just about a half dozen or so actually making it to kind of shovel-ready status.
And how, from the domestic perspective, does the situation with the Bangsamoro Basic Law and the continuing peace process and reconciliation process in Mindanao, in your view, impact the election and the political environment?
The Aquino government clearly wants to see peace in Mindanao as one of its legacies, if not its foremost legacy. If they can effectively pass this law setting up a new autonomous region in the predominantly Muslim areas of Mindanao, we could see a long-term resolution to a decades-long insurgency. There will still be splinter group violence. We're seeing that already with some groups that have split off from the MILF. But what long-term, I think what the Aquino administration would like to see is that this will free up desperately needed resources that have gone in for decades to both police and military to preventing violence spreading in the south, and it'll open up vast areas of the relatively undeveloped Mindanao and Sular Archipelago and other areas of the south to investment, including agriculture. It seems to be a big possibility. You've already got some interest from Japanese conglomerates, among others. So the knock-on effects of this succeeding are, they could be enormous. That said, this is a very difficult issue to navigate politically in the Philippines. It raises some constitutional questions. There's concern that it wouldn't end violence anyway. There's concern of kind of a creeping Islamization that seems wildly unfair, but you do hear that narrative in the legislature. So the process of getting from a peace deal to legislation implementing it has taken far longer than the government wanted. It seems likely at this point that even if they get the legislation passed in the current session of Congress, that implementation of the deal is not going to be possible before Aquino steps down or leaves office next May.
You mentioned Aquino's legacy in one area of foreign policy has had a particularly significant impact is the Philippine relationship with China, and also in the focus on Philippine military spending. We heard the news reported that he will submit a budget for 2016 of $552 million U.S., which is a significant increase for the Philippines. In terms of the election, we have a bit of a challenge because from the Philippine perspective, you have candidates that may not pursue the same assertive policy towards China, and they're also in desperate need of military modernization.
Right. So one of the things, if not the thing that the Aquino administration, like it or not, will be most remembered for is a deterioration in the relationship with China. Not necessarily Manila's fault, but it is what it is. The Aquino administration took a much harder line on questions of sovereignty and maritime rights in the South China Sea than did his predecessor. Whether or not another president will stick to that line is an unknown. Vice President Binay has already suggested that he would be more open to cutting a deal with China, so to speak. That might very well involve dropping the case that the Philippines is currently pursuing under arbitration with an UNCLOS at the Hague at the moment. Senator Poe has been less outspoken on the issue. We don't exactly know where she stands, although she does again caucus with Aquino's coalition in the Congress. She's a pragmatist. She's U.S. educated. There's nothing to suggest that she would necessarily sell out, in a sense, Philippine national interests to China, but there's no guarantee that she would take the same strident approach Aquino has. That said, I think all of the candidates, and certainly the political establishment in Manila writ large, recognizes the frankly embarrassing state of the Philippine military. It's the weakest armed forces in the region, at least in maritime Southeast Asia. Decades of underinvestment in the Navy and the Air Force, driven in part because the mission of the armed forces since independence has been preventing insurgency in the South and fighting the communist insurgency that's still going on around the country. They're finally in a position, thanks in part to the peace process in Mindanao, where the government is heavily investing now in modernization of the Air Force, the Navy, and the newly established Coast Guard. That said, even with this larger spending that the Aquino administration has signaled they'd like, and this is part of a larger 15-year deal that would be worth about $21 billion of modernization, they're still starting from virtually nothing. When you look at comparative advantages re China or even their Southeast Asian neighbors, so when Philippine officials talk about, for instance, the minimum credible defense capability they'd like to build, essentially to not be able to defeat the Chinese in an armed conflict, but to at least raise the costs of bullying, to make it clear that if you come at us, you get a bloody nose. To be able to do that seems virtually impossible over the short term, or even medium term, given their budget constraints. The only way they get there is with enormous help, primarily from the U.S., but also other partners.
So the last piece of the puzzle, Greg, that we haven't touched on yet too deeply is the relationship with the United States. What do you see as the status of EDCA going forward? Obviously, right now it's tied up in the Philippine judiciary. How will that impact the Philippines' defense prospects down the road?
Renewing the relationship with the Philippines has been a huge part of the strategy of both the Aquino administration and the Obama administration when it comes to the rebalance or pivot to Asia. Now, that extends beyond just the security, but in the security realm, clearly the hallmark piece here is the EDCA, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, which Presidents Obama and Aquino, well, it was signed by our ambassador just before President Obama visited Manila early last year. It's been wrapped up in the courts, as you say, in Manila for almost a year and a half now. The best guess is that we might get a decision sometime in September, although that decision might just be that it has to get kicked back to the Senate, where it can face further deliberations. So whether or not this gets concluded in the Aquino administration is becoming a question mark. It desperately needs to be, and I think that kind of careful policy watchers in both Washington and Manila recognize that. Any new president, when they come in, becomes a question mark. Do they want to continue Aquino's legacy? Do they find the EDCA to be worth the effort? It is a hard political sell in a country with a history of opposing a U.S. footprint, but it is desperately needed. As I said, without this kind of U.S. support, the Philippines simply cannot stand up to Chinese coercion in the South China Sea over the long term. The EDCA will not only increase the access of U.S. troops, planes, and ships to do kind of rotational presence in the Philippines, not permanent basing, but have access to Philippine bases. It will allow the U.S. to pre-position equipment in the Philippines, which is hugely important for kind of emergency response in areas like the South China Sea, but also for things like search and rescue operations, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, etc. But most importantly, it will allow the U.S. to essentially pay for and undertake infrastructure upgrades at Philippine military facilities. So when you look at somewhere like Palawan, where the Filipinos would desperately like to build a new naval and air station at Oyster Bay or Puerto Princesa, they lack any fueling capacity on Palawan, they lack significant harbor facilities, and they lack the money and ability to do all of this in the short term. Whereas the U.S. military could very much invest in things like renewing or revamping airstrips, dredging out harbors, building all the support infrastructure you need, be it fueling, telecoms, and whatnot, because they'll also be using those facilities. Without that agreement, the U.S. is going to seriously question whether or not the Philippines has the wherewithal to kind of stick at its guns here in the South China Sea. And the Filipinos are going to be in a quickly losing match when it comes to their own military modernization plans.
And I want to just close out with a quick question about the state of play in the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Obviously, the Philippines filed a case against China a couple years ago now. The hearings have completed in The Hague. What is your sense on when a judgment verdict will be passed down from the judiciary?
Well, we just saw the conclusion of several days of hearings on whether or not the court has jurisdiction and whether or not the evidence is admissible. Some of the Philippine legal team has said it could take as much as 90 days to get a ruling on that. That would take us through to maybe late September, early August. That's probably a very conservative estimate. We might get a ruling beforehand. I fully expect that the judges will find they have jurisdiction. If they find they have jurisdiction, then it's almost inconceivable that the Philippines won't win at least part of its case. The Philippine side has indicated they expect another round of hearings on the merits of the case in November, most likely. So after that, it's a matter of whether the judges need more time, more hearings, more questions. There are some who say the case now, because they've split into these two different hearings, one on jurisdiction, one on merits, could slide a year or more. I still find that the most likely scenario involves a ruling sometime next spring or early summer, which means that we'll either be in the twilight days of the Aquino administration or early in his successor's administration. If it goes farther than that, there is the real concern, and in Beijing, probably the real hope, that a replacement president who's more likely to be willing to drop the case could come in before a judgment comes down.
Greg Poling, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Greg Poling. And now on to our one to watch. Does the Pacific Ocean have a fever this year? Meteorologists project that a super El Nino event could be possible this year, affecting weather patterns around the world and into early 2016. With ocean temperatures in July tracking with the previous record event in 1997, a strong El Nino may be coming to visit the Pacific Rim. The more heat that the Pacific absorbs this summer and fall, the more significant the impacts will be, including, but not limited to, heightened typhoon and cyclone activity across the Asia-Pacific, heavy rains in California, a moderate winter for North America, and a below-average hurricane season in the Atlantic. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitated.com and csis.org. Also, check out our island tracker and maritime-specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.